Statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Inspirational women are increasingly popular in the news and media, but many go unheard and their stories are never told. Women to Watch with Susan Rocco captures the stories of many women who truly make a difference. Women to Watch is the vehicle for developing new leaders, encouraging younger generations, and in building self-esteem for future entrepreneurs.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch here on WWDB, Talk 860, and womentowatch.net. I'm happy to be back in the studio today after a week off. I wanted to mention to you why I was out last week. We actually taped another segment for our Women to Watch on the Road series, and I sat down with Kay Koplovitz, the founder of USA Network, in New York last week. So stay tuned for that video and interview that I did with her. We'll be posting it shortly, most likely the end of this week or next week. I want to give a quick shout out and a thank you as well to one of my favorite listeners, Christine McGinnis, who I will just simply say has been taking very good care of my mom and dad. So thank you, Christine. Lastly, I want to give out our call-in number. If you're listening to the show and you'd like to call in and ask a question of our guest, we would love to hear from you. You can do so by dialing 888-329-3306. That's 888-329-3306. I'd like to welcome to the show this afternoon a very special guest. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to share her story. Her name is Deborah Brenner, and Deborah is the president and founder of Women of the Vine and Spirits. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much.
And as you said, I wish we had an opportunity to meet in person, but I'm happy to have you calling in the show as well.
Yes, I would like to, in the near future, to meet in person.
And where are you calling in from today?
So I am based in Rockland County, New York. It's just 15 miles north of the George Washington Bridge from the city.
Okay. And is that where your main office for women?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, listen, I would love to start talking to you about your growing up years a little bit. I understand you were born in the Bronx, but you were raised in Pearl River, New York, the youngest of three girls, and with mom and dad. And I wonder if you could just talk for a few minutes about what that was like growing up there.
You know, we moved up to the suburbs, like many people, when they, you know, started having families and left the city. So I was three at the time. Coming into the suburbs, it was a really small, quiet town, a wonderful neighborhood. It was a great place to grow up, I have to say. It was not nearly as built up as it is today in the area. There were lots of farms still around and just a wonderful place for children to be able to roam. And we had so much freedom to get on our bikes, to go all around, and just small town USA, which I really love being in. So I'm not a huge city dweller, but I did commute and work in Manhattan for many years. But it's nice being outside. So it was really a wonderful childhood, a loving family, and a great neighborhood of lots of friends and neighbors to play with and to hang out with.
So where did you get your love of science? Because I understand while you graduated with a degree in English and journalism, you actually started with an interest in biology.
Yes, I did. I have to say, as a kid, I was a very, very curious kid. I wanted to know about everything. So I drove my parents crazy because I was so interested in so many different things. It was like I would come home saying I was going to be something different growing up my whole, you know, every day
every
with something
day.
Different.
Yeah.
I would get excited or passionate or learn about something, and that was just, you know, so I guess for me, the science side, especially growing up and spending so much time outdoors, I was fascinated just, just on the biology side with the science of, the farms and the trees and the grass and everything that was around me. I wanted to know more about it and how it all worked.
You know, that's interesting to me because, you know, obviously I have interviewed many, many successful women, and I would say that curiosity is definitely a commonality among women who have achieved great things.
That's good to, you know, I never really thought about it because, you know, it definitely is what drove me. I went into the University of Delaware as a biology major. I came out graduating in arts and science as a English with minor in journalism. So definitely think my curiosity took me down that path.
Yeah.
I was meant for journalism because I was too interested in too many subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't make up my mind that I could delve into just one subject deeply. And that would be my path for the rest of my life. So
yeah.
The journalism opened up my curiosity, and I got to delve into anything I was interested in. So.
Yeah, that's right, through storytelling, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And it's a great lesson, I think, as well for young people to understand that, you know, just because you're interested in one topic one day does not mean that you cannot stray and take a different path down the road.
Absolutely. I mean, I tell that to my nieces now. You know, like you mentioned, I am the youngest of three girls, and I have three nieces. So they're, you know, I think that's also a big part of what has shaped me is there hasn't been any boys growing up in our household. I didn't grow up with brothers. I think, you know, I don't have nephews. And it's so interesting to see how that can shape me and what I'm doing today. But I tell them all the time, not only did I make the change when I was younger, but I also reinvented myself later in life as well.
That's right. That's right. And we will be talking about that. So tell me a little bit about your 4 years at the University of Delaware. What kinds of activities and things were you involved in outside of the classroom?
Well, I was always a very big reader. I love to read, so I spent a lot of time, you know, in the university also just reading. Again, I think that was a big choice for me to change majors because I enjoyed literature and fiction, nonfiction so much. So I did a lot of that. I also was a soccer player, so came out of high school playing soccer and captain of my team in soccer. So I dabbled a little bit in co-ed, you know, soccer at college, but didn't actually play for a team, but just in some clubs and things like that. So, and then I really spent most of my time exploring, meeting people from other majors because it was fascinating to see what other people were involved in. My friends were involved in all kinds of different majors, and I think that was one of the most exciting things is to see what they were learning.
Mm-hmm.
As well, because
yeah.
they you know, chose all kinds of, and today it's very different because young people today, entrepreneurial studies is everywhere, which did not exist when I went to the university.
That's right. That's right. Yes, there's entire programs now, right, just to study
Definitely.
Entrepreneurship. You graduated then the University of Delaware, and was it right out of school that you landed the job in television and film?
Well, in my senior year, I did two internships in local television stations. So my journalism side, I did explore radio and I explored print, but I had this opportunity in television. And, I mean, showing my age, this was before all of the digital technology that we have today. So I got hooked on the fact that I was playing with all this equipment that, you know, none of us had at home, where now you have half of the editing equipment right in your iPhone. So that really was a lot of fun. And upon graduation, through a family friend, I got hired to work at the Olympics in 1988 in Seoul, Korea, as a production assistant for NBC. And so I took my graduation money and bought a ticket and was off to Korea that September for 2.5 months.
Wow. So. That must have been an amazing experience.
It was. I look back at it now because, again, it was before the internet and before cell phones, and I think, my gosh, how did I do that by myself? I didn't know anybody.
Yeah.
And it was so far away in a foreign country, and I had traveled a lot as a young child, but of course you can't even read the signs or anything because it's not using the same alphabet. So I think, wow, that was pretty brave or crazy.
Yes, I think that says a lot about you because, as you mentioned, there was no, you know, staying in touch. Today, when our kids travel and they're away from us, we can be texting and checking up on them every day, all day long.
Absolutely. I mean, my niece just did her studies abroad, and we're FaceTiming. I'm thinking,
right.
You know, what was crazy about Korea is here I'm, you know, 18 years old, I was actually 20. I turned 21 while I was in Korea, so
okay.
I got to celebrate my 21st birthday over there. But what was so crazy is that I would have to call home, you know, using your dial through the, you know, AT&T and all of that at 8 in the morning to get my parents at 6 p.m. the
right.
night before,
right.
you know,
yes,
to
yes.
say I was okay. So,
right.
yeah, it was a wonderful experience, I have to say. And, again, everything that you do in life, you don't realize it at the time, but it all comes in as a learning experience to shape us for where we're going.
Did your parents encourage adventure in you and your sisters?
My parents loved to travel. So I grew up, my parents married for 54 years before my dad passed away three and a half years ago. So I grew up in a really nice, you know, environment. And my parents had a passion for travel. So they instilled that in us very young. They took us traveling, and I think a lot of that is where my passion for the wine industry grew, was because my dad enjoyed wine. They enjoyed fine dining and traveling. So I got introduced to it as a very young child. They kind of taught us how to behave so they could take us out with them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's very smart of them. So they
yes.
can continue to travel even though they had, you know, three small children.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, it is what your experience, what you learn growing up, and I think that just all of us, my sisters and I have a passion for travel, for cultures, for meeting people, and again, see, I think that's where it comes into storytelling.
Mm, yes. Yes, I agree. So, you spent close to 20 years in what one would call a male-dominated field, high-end technology. What was that like for you at the time? Did you even notice that, you know, you were one of few women, or were you just kind of ingrained in the work and head down and doing what you loved?
Well, I followed my passion from television into a company that actually created the technology used in television and film. And it was, you know, we were working in high-definition television in 1992, 93, so that's how advanced they were, because most
yes.
people never even heard of it until the last few years
yes.
Here. So I noticed it once I got promoted into more of a management role. When I started there, I was a young person working in marketing and training, and I was out in the field a lot. So I was really out in, you know, working with people in television and film studios around the U.S. and also internationally. But as I got promoted, that's when I was the only woman to become a director at the company in the U.S. at that time.
Mm.
So there were very few women in the office that maybe wasn't in an administrative capacity.
Okay.
So I really was very different. And traveling, I would often be the only woman out of most of the dinners that I attended, most of the trips that I attended, and conferences, very, very few women, if sometimes often I could have been the only one.
And did you, how did you feel, that, you know, in those situations? Did you feel out of place?
Well, you know, I, like I said, I think growing up without any brothers in the house, you know, I wasn't accustomed to seeing the gender differences day to day that just naturally occur because, you know, we were, of course, my dad was with us, but he was my father. He wasn't at my age level. So that's when I really started noticing the difference in how I was being treated compared to my male counterparts, how isolating it was. You know, I could do just as good a job as any of the men there, but at one point I was told that I wasn't getting a promotion because they thought that a woman couldn't handle it. And I was crushed. Now, at that time, you know, I did say, I don't think that that's permissible to actually say, but, you know, we're talking in a long time ago before women were really talking about these issues, and I didn't have any role models, and I didn't have any, you know, real colleagues to talk about this with. So I accepted it, and sure enough, a year later, that gentleman was not able to do the job that was required, and they ended up letting him go and giving me the job.
Oh, there you go.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah.
You know, it's. And a lot of, you know, young women I meet today, and they don't encounter necessarily that because today what we call it is unspoken bias, right? So then they actually said it. So maybe you knew where you stood. Today there's still a lot that goes on, but it's unspoken. Mm. So I think the challenges today are quite different, but they still remain very much the same.
Would you say that it varies field to field, or do you think it's the same, that relationship, business relationship between men and women, no matter the industry?
Well, I think that, you know, when I wanted to pursue my passion in the wine industry and to make a change, I was very disheartened by corporate America. The further I got up the ladder, like I said, the more I realized how unhappy I was, how isolating it was, especially for a woman in such a male-dominated industry. So, you know, I think at that time I was searching my soul for something that I was passionate about, something that I could, that I would want to do. Mm. And I, like I said, growing up with farmland around me and other things, I had a passion and took a trip to California, and that's where I discovered in Napa and Sonoma all the women that were behind many of the famous brands that I knew and loved, but had no idea women were behind the scenes, and I had no idea how male-dominated the industry was. So to answer your question, what I found was the feelings and the issues that I was challenged and faced with were the same. I think it does, you know, relate to women in all industries.
Can you talk about that experience? So that trip to Napa and Sonoma, where, you know, it really became apparent to you, was there a conversation that you had, or was it just your general observation while there?
It was both, but the conversation was really the catalyst. So it was very clear in you know, spending some time in researching to look at a career change into that industry, where it resulted with me taking the trip after a lot of research to see if it was something viable for me. But during a lunch that I had with Karen Cakebread, she was introduced to me by a mutual friend, and she used to work for she worked for Hewlett-Packard, so she was in the tech industry before she joined Cakebread Cellars and joined the family business with her husband at the time. So we started talking about how male-dominated both industries were, and that conversation really piqued my interest, and of course my journalist side kicked in when I came back to my home in New York. I started researching for the women behind the scenes, and we're talking about 2004, 2005, and it was before the marketing was really looking at the woman consumer. There was very, very little in the wine industry written about these women, and that's where it was the catalyst for me to say, I want to write this book. I want to know more about it, and that's what I ended up doing.
If you're listening, I'm speaking with Deborah Brenner this afternoon, president and founder of Women of the Vine and Spirits. My next question really was, what inspired you to write the book? So other than the fact that you just are someone who enjoys stories and you're an avid reader, it takes a lot of guts, I would say, to write a book in general, right? You're kind of going out on a limb and taking a risk. What was it that truly inspired you to do it, that took you from the idea to actually sitting down and doing it?
At the time, I was going through a divorce, so it was very painful for me. It was a painful time in my life. I was disenchanted in my corporate life, didn't know where I wanted to go, and then found myself getting divorced. And the circumstances around that. So it was a very tough time for my life. And when I interviewed the first woman on the phone saying I had this idea, I wanted to write the book, and talking about storytelling, that's what encouraged me to take the risk and to write the book, because I thought I was going to tell their stories just to help inspire others. What I didn't expect is how much it inspired and encouraged me. The stories that the women started sharing with me, the trials and tribulations, the blood, sweat, and tears that they had, their successes, their failures, their divorces, their marriages, it was remarkable how much they shared. And they just encouraged me. It made me realize that when you put your mind to something and when you're passionate about something, you can make it work. And they also really encouraged me to take risks, because they worked for Mother Nature. So I thought I had it bad, but they would talk about frost and storms and their harvests, and I just was so inspired by them that I knew that I felt compelled, that I wanted them to be recognized, and I wanted to share their stories because I wanted others to get out of it from the same that I was personally getting from them.
Wow. Would you describe that as a cathartic experience, writing that book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to say that, and it's funny that you say that, Susan, because I've used that word myself when I was first going out and talking to people about the book and doing some book signings, that it was very cathartic. I think that what the women don't realize is how much they helped me heal and move on with my life. Mm-hmm. And that's where the reinvention occurred. There was no wanting to go back. And I called a few of the women that I met while writing the book, and I said, what if we went ahead and started the first collaborative wine label of artists and women winemakers and continued our story? And they said, we're in. And that was it. The next steps were taken.
Yeah.
So it's a crazy journey. You don't know, but
That's right. You never know, right, where one experience is going to take you. I want to mention the name of the book for the listeners: "Women of the Vine: Inside the World of Women Who Make, Taste, and Enjoy Wine." How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, the crazy thing is, I thought I would have more time. And then while I was still in the research phase and the interview phase, I started pitching to publishers. And And I got a publisher interested, and they said, well, we want it for the holidays. So, you know, I needed to have it done within about 2.5 months.
Oh, boy. Oh, my gosh. Talk about pressure.
So I said yes, and then I got in the elevator after a big, huge meeting in a very big, you know, conference room, got in the elevator and said, oh, my God, what did I just do? You know, but again, this is where I like to tell people sometimes, you know, opportunity comes to you. And I knew at that point that that was basically saying, you know, take it. You're on the next step of your journey. Mm. And there was no way I would say no, because again, I wanted to make it happen. And so I said yes, and I, you know, put my head down and started really working on it full time.
Yeah. So at that time, were you only writing, or, you know, what was your source of revenue at that time?
Well, the crazy thing is when, like I said, I was disenchanted, and then I found myself going through the divorce, and I was really in a very bad state, and I was commuting to New York City every day, and I went ahead and I quit my job, and it was a very big, you know, I was a director of marketing and business development in a technology firm. I was making, you know, what people would say very successful, mm-hmm. six figures, company car, and all the nice things that, you know, you would have to be comfortable.
Right.
I would not advise the listeners to do what I did, because now I'm, you know, going to be without any income and without my spouse's income. But for me, it was something it was my aha moment. And wow. I was freelancing in the industry, mm-hmm. for many months as I was researching to go into the wine business to continue. But I needed the time. I needed the breathing room. And so freelancing gave me that breathing room to say, I need to figure this out, because I realized it wasn't just a change of company or a change of, you know, location. It was a full change in what I was doing career-wise that I was yearning for, and I needed that breathing room. So the freelance gave me that, and when I got the book deal, that's when I had to give up my freelance time and use my savings and say, this is a sign. I have 2.5 months to reinvent, to go into something completely new that I'm passionate about. And that's how I ended up, you know, doing that.
Mm. You know, I would say that's an example of listening to that inner voice, isn't it? And really being brave enough to follow it.
You know, I speak to so many women that are yearning for a big change, and it's very hard. But I have to say now, I think what would have been harder is if I spent the last 15, 16 years in something that I was unhappy in.
Right.
I can't picture that. Mm. Had I not got out of my comfort zone, made myself take that risk, and you know, it's well worth it. But at the time, yes, it's very hard. And you have to be willing to make those sacrifices that come with it, you know, because it comes with a lot of sacrifice. Like I said, you know, you give up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say that even when I was, you know, struggling, I felt I was leading a richer life than I was in my corporate life, mm-hmm. because I was doing something I was passionate about and doing something that I enjoyed.
Right. We are going to take a very quick break, Deborah, for our sponsors. And when we come back, I want to talk about the Artisan Women Winemakers and the label that you started. We'll be right back.
This is Kristen Hilsley, financial advisor of the Foley Hilsley Group, with a big announcement. Last fall, I hosted a women's lifestyle conference to help the women who do it all take control of their finances. Now I'm excited to announce a new partnership with Women to Watch Media to help show women how to own their financial future. We'll have newsletter articles, blog posts, announcements of live events, and a lot more, all available at womentowatch.net and our own website, foleyhilsleygroup.com. I'm thrilled about this new partnership, and I look forward to being your resource for all things financial. Stay tuned to learn more or visit our website at foleyhilsleygroup.com. The Foley Hilsley Group is affiliated with Robert W. Baird & Company, member SIPC. Log on to foleyhilsleygroup.com to learn more. That's FOLEYHILLSLEY group.com. Or call 610-238-6636.
Since 1858, Mount St. Joseph Academy has been educating girls to be leaders, founders, and independent thinkers. Students are taught to be collaborative, courageous, compassionate, confident, and spiritual. In this student-centered environment, the young women are transformed by recognizing their own potential and are encouraged to use it to make a difference in the world. To learn more about Mount St. Joseph Academy, go to www.msjacad.org or call 215-233-3177. That's msjacad.org or 215-233-3177. Welcome back, everyone, and thank you so much for listening to another week of Women to Watch here on WWDB, Talk 860, and womentowatch.net. My name is Sue Rocco, and I'm speaking this afternoon with Deborah Brenner. Deborah is the president and founder of Women of the Vine and Spirits. And just before the break, we were, you know, talking about your courage to kind of step away from a corporate job that really was not fulfilling for you, and writing a book. And of course, what that led to was your idea to develop a first-of-its-kind collection of seven artisan women winemakers from Napa, Sonoma, and Paso Robles. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So my first question is, how did you find these seven women?
Well, most of it came through the research I was doing for the book. So two of the women I met while writing the book, and then the others, it was because we were looking for particular varietals and particular, wines that we wanted to introduce and produce in the portfolio. So that's how the other women came on board as well. The remarkable thing is that once other women started hearing about what we were doing, I started receiving emails from women around the world, from Greece, from Spain, and Italy, and France, saying, you know, how can we get involved? So it was really remarkable to see that people were recognizing that we were this collective of women, you know, coming together.
Yeah.
Obviously, the objective for me was really the fact that I wanted to raise awareness of women that were so under-recognized in such a male-dominated industry. However, what I didn't realize is that, you know, having to produce and sell the product, so the winemakers did what they did well, and my role in the collective was to do the sales and the marketing, and in the United States, you have to go through a distributor. So it's quite a difficult process in selling the wine. And at the end, we had a good 7 years, but at the end of it, it wasn't achieving what we had hoped in raising the awareness, because our message was just, it was hard to get it out there through the channels that were available. And this was, you know, just prior to direct-to-consumer sales for wine. So, today, many wineries are really utilizing social media and everything else. But we were, I think, a little bit before our time. So,
yes. Well, and it's extremely competitive as well. Would you happen to know a statistic on how many winemakers there are, even in just the U.S.?
Well, it's extremely competitive. I mean, just wineries alone, when you look at all the wine and the fact that wineries, you know, are now in every 50 states in the U.S. alone,
mm-hmm.
The amount of wineries that now are there. But then look at it, it's the oldest globally traded industry in the world. I mean, wine, you know, was produced back in the Mesopotamia days. So on a global scale, there's also, so the competition is massive.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a whole different level, like you're saying. And as far as women winemakers, you know, there isn't a full statistic internationally, but California, as of today, about 10% of the winemakers are women. Yet more and more women are going through the enology departments and graduating, but they're also wonderful, incredible, powerful women in all sectors of the industry today.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have a ways to go.
Yeah. Well, when you look back, Deborah, of course, the sales and the marketing of the company is always one of the greatest difficulties for any business. And with the advancement of technology today, do you look back and think, had you had those resources there, things might have been different?
You know, I think some things would be different, but all in all, I mean, I have the utmost respect for all the men and women in the industry, and you have to be passionate and love, because it is highly competitive on a global scale, and it's very difficult, even with the resources that you have,
mm-hmm.
And also because you're also working with a product that, you know, it's not so much on the spirit side, because spirits you can make all the time, but with wine, it is it's produced in the vineyard, so you get once a year to really craft your product.
Right. Yes.
It's not something that you can do all the time and work to perfect it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and then Mother Nature
right.
is in control.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a process. But I have to say that the years that I had the wine brand and working with the women winemakers and working with our distributors and our retailers and restaurants, it was fabulous. And even when we kind of felt, you know, financially, where do we go next? What do we do? I knew that I was staying in this business. That was it. This was the business that I fell in love with, because I fell in love with the people.
Well, how wonderful that is, that you went through that experience and it didn't deter you. You know, you didn't take that as a sign, now I need to do something different. I wonder if you can share with the listeners how you moved through that time, because, you know, entrepreneurs put so much of their blood, sweat, and tears, as they say, into creating a business. And to have it not sustain is incredibly difficult. You know, you've described this yourself as one of your greatest personal and professional you use the word failures, but I think, you know, we should in business always look at a failure as a lesson. But talk about how, you know, what was it that got you through that time?
Once again, I have to say, as a reader and a storyteller, which is my passion, it was reading lots of books by entrepreneurs, you know, Richard Branson, reading his stories, his failures, his vision, his perseverance, people like him and many others. And it also was a lot of the women that I met along the way that really, you know, got me through it. I knew financially it wasn't sustainable. It wasn't happening. And I was sitting in my office one day, and I was just, you know, I hung up the phone, I'm typing on the computer, and I just put my head down and cried. And I just knew, I said, you know, it's time.
Mm-hmm.
You know when it's time.
Yes. Right.
You do everything as an entrepreneur to keep it alive. And then at some point you just realize that it's time to let it go. You know, you got to let your baby go.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the hardest, is when, because I'm not a quitter, and I, you know, want to persevere as much as possible, but you do have to reach a point of saying, you know, when do you realize that it's time to let go? What I'm very grateful, like I said, is I didn't want to let go of this business. I didn't want to let go of the industry and my passion for it. And what I had to do was look at what did I have and where could I take it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, it doesn't necessarily have to be completely gone. And what I'm most proud of is the fact that it evolved.
That's right.
Into what it is today.
Right.
And I truly feel that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. And believe it or not, Sue, what I'm doing today actually speaks more to my vision of wanting to champion for women in such a male-dominated industry.
That's exactly
than
right.
what I was doing before.
That's right. That's exactly right. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Deborah Brenner, president and founder of Women of the Vine and Spirits. And so, Deborah, you did exactly that. You moved on, and in March of 2015, you organized the inaugural Women of the Vine Global and Spirits Symposium. And again, that's taking another risk and being gutsy, because that takes a lot of work and preparation and collaboration, and you want this event to be successful. Let me ask you this. What was your mission at that time in deciding to do that?
It was, the catalyst for me to do it was a conversation I had with a gentleman named Ben Salisbury, who worked at Constellation at the time, knew what I was doing when I had the Collective Wine label, had reached out saying, you know, I love what you're doing, you know, I'd love to see how maybe I could get involved in someday. And then he was leaving a big corporate job himself, taking a huge risk to go out on his own. And it prompted a phone call. And during our conversation, that's when I, you know, shared with him that the Collective label was shutting down, that it was time to let it go. But during the conversation and speaking with him about the women that reached out to me, what was so remarkable was I realized that, like I said, Sue, people were reaching out to me saying, how can I get involved? And they were using the word. They're saying, I'm a woman of the vine. I'm in Spain. My sister's a woman of the vine.
Yeah.
She's a sommelier.
Wow.
You know, my mom is a woman of the vine. She's in viticulture. She works for a distributor. She works, you know, for a steakhouse, or she, you know, is a buyer at you know, a grocery store with wine. So this started happening, and it happened before. What I realized during this phone conversation, and then I went back and I started reading those emails that encouraged me all those years, and they were saying, how can we be involved? And I'm thinking, be involved in what? I don't have an organization.
What are we going
to be involved in? And that's when the light bulb said, wait a second, you know, I belong to National Association of Women Business Owners. I belonged, when I started this business, to the Rockland Business Association, to the Women's Business Network, you know, and I said, oh my gosh, you know, there is no forum, there's no organization for women in this, you know, very difficult industry, very traditionally male-dominated industry, for us to come together. And what I realized is not only was there a need, but there was a demand by the women, because they were reaching out to me and thought already that that's what this small little collective of seven of us, they wanted to be a part of.
You know, that's so interesting to me, because it's almost as if you had your members before you even created the organization.
You know, I think you're right, because like I said, there was seven of us, but the perception, and it was because we did garner a lot of media. You know, we just couldn't turn that into the sales that we needed to sustain after 7+ years,
mm-hmm.
which was a good run, but we had no shortage of attention. I mean, people were inviting us to host wine tastings with the New York Women's Bar Association. 3 years in a row, I was at the State Department for National Women's History, you know, Month and Women's History Day. We were at the Kennedy Center for Vital Voices for their big gala event for, you know, human rights as women's rights. And so people were seeing, like, wait a second, if we want to celebrate the spirit of women breaking the glass ceiling in other industries, we want to celebrate with Women of the Vine. So that's what's, you know, we got a lot of attention. And so to your point, women were reaching out saying, how can I get involved? And from all sectors, from women in banking that finances, wineries and distilleries and craft breweries, to women legal counsel, to cooperage and packaging design. So it was coming from so many different areas of the wine and spirits industry, and that's what led me to take the chance. What I thought could be a one-off event, I said, okay, I'm going to take a risk. It was a huge amount of money. You can imagine, signing on the dotted line to put on, not knowing if I'd sell one ticket or get one corporate partner.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I prayed for 250 people to show up, and we sold out in 12 weeks to 500 people. The tickets sold, the corporate partners started coming on board. The largest wine and spirits distributor in the country came on board first with Southern Glaciers Wine and Spirits, and then all of a sudden, you know, Young's Market and RNDC and Breakthrough and Horizon and Martinetti, and then the suppliers, the Gallo and Rodney Strong and Bacardi, and it just started.
Oh my
gosh.
And it
snowballed.
Yeah.
And it snowballed that it couldn't be a one-off event. You can't be a catalyst for change. And we created a movement, and so it had to be year-round. So the summer after hosting the inaugural symposium in March, I spent that summer building out the year-round trade organization. And today, it's now international in scope.
That's amazing. That is amazing. You know, it kind of guided you. It just, you know, developed and organically grew. And again, you know, you had the members, people that wanted something that they could be a part of that would provide the support and the resources and the celebration of it.
Yes, and the thing is that what the individuals wanted was this was a void that has existed for so long. I have women on my advisory board that have been in this industry for 30-plus years and never had an opportunity to network, to mentor each other, the learning opportunities in all facets of the industry, because it takes so many people in so many different areas, right, from production and growing to sales and putting it on a shelf. So we, like I said, for the individuals, this was just something that they craved, to be able to come together, and the camaraderie.
Right, the community building, yeah.
The support, the mentorship. And then for the corporate partners, what was so remarkable to see that these companies were coming out and supporting our mission by financially supporting our efforts and getting involved, is that they realized that this was an opportunity finally for them to demonstrate to their employees and to potential employees, which creates for retention of great talent, mm-hmm. and, you know, basically, you know, recruiting new talent, but also to tell the industry at large that they truly support gender diverse teams and they're developing talent, and they were able to, you know, really come on board and start working together. And I have to say that now, in just a short amount of time, going into our third year, the Alliance has become a catalyst for increasing gender diversity initiatives in the industry. So we're actually hosting our first executive summit this September, September 13 in New York City, and it's a full day of the industry influencers coming together strictly to share our practices of diversity and women's initiatives so that we can start working as a, you know, an industry unit towards having more women in leadership roles. Not only does it make sense, you know, because 67% of wine consumers are women. So we dominate in wine, we dominate in spirits, and yet we need to, it makes sense to have more women leaders in this industry, especially because the women consumer is driving the trends. And so at the end of the day, it's good for the bottom line for everybody.
That's right. That's right. That's fantastic. We just have a few minutes left, Deborah. Tell me about this year's event, and tell me what about the business model for the symposium.
So for the Women of the Vine and Spirits Trade Alliance, it's now year-round. We have a job board, discussion boards. We do webinars. So we have many components of educational. We also just awarded four recipients out of our Women of the Vine and Spirits Foundation with the scholarship fund. So we're very proud of starting that. That's a new endeavor as well. And as far as the business model, like many trade organizations, we offer individual membership. So individuals that would like to join the Alliance and have access to our network and our programs and our activities and our events, that's $150 to join annual dues. And then we're supported by our corporate partners, and there's many different corporate partner levels from associate all the way up to diamond levels, so that we can be inclusive to corporate partners of all sizes. So we have small companies, we have small family-owned wineries, all the way up to, like I said, the largest distributors, the largest supply, you know, companies like Constellation and Diageo and things like that, that are, you know, treasury wine that are in the world. So we really offer a diverse package for people. And that's really the business model, is through our membership and our corporate partners. And then we are anchored by the annual Global Symposium. So all the activities we do during the year, we've expanded into Europe. We'll be hosting some workshops at Wine to Wine in Verona, Italy. In December, we are hosting the summit. We're going to be in Paso Robles, actually, on the 26th. We're hosting regional events. So there's a lot of activity, as well as mentorship programs to basically ensure for the next generation of leaders.
You know, you've done an incredible amount going into only your third year. That's a lot. I mean, really, this started in 2015, and, you know, we're halfway through 2017, and my goodness, look how much it has grown and expanded, and it's doing great, great things for women.
Well, it's, you know, I have the women to thank, and I also have to thank all of the men that are involved, because we encourage the men to participate with us. This isn't, you know, something in a movement and a catalyst for change. We're going to do this together.
That's right.
And the support that we've gotten from the male executives is they want to see the women, you know, step up and say, you know, we want to have more executive leaders. So they're a great part of our support. And I have all of them to thank, because honestly, I like to say I'm like, you know, I am started this, I founded it, but without their support, and like you said, look at how much we've accomplished in such a short period of time. And I think that's because a movement has many people, right? So it's not just me. It's all of the men and women out there that are, you know, rallying around this mission and this support and wanting to do so much more. I mean, I just wish we could, you know, do more and more, and we're growing very, very quickly.
Right.
And the future is to keep, you know, keep giving education, mentorship, and opportunities really is what it's all about.
Well, I'll be excited to continue to follow you, Deborah, and your work, and perhaps we might be able to collaborate on something together at some point. I thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and sharing your story. It's a great, great story. And we'll be sure to share your contact information and website and all of that good stuff with our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I hope that my story can just inspire others no matter what they wanted to do. But it is, you know, obviously our passions, our storytelling that you know, unites us all.
That's right.
As
yes.
women.
Yes.
And so I'm proud to share mine and hope that it helps inspire others to step out of their comfort zones and pursue their passions as well.
Yeah, I have no doubt that it will. Thank you so much, Deborah, and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you. You too, Sue. Take care.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch here on WWDB, Talk 860, and womentowatch.net. Be sure to visit our website for all things pertaining to the show at womentowatch.net. That's women, the number two, watch.net, N-E-T. Have a great week, everyone.